This is HPR episode 2230 entitled Linux.conf.0 2017, Donna Benjamin, and is part of the series Interviews. It is hosted by Clinton Roy and is about 33 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is: Clinton interviews speaker and previous Linux.conf.0 organizer Donna Benjamin.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Here we are on day 3 of LinuxConf.au down in Hobart. I am here with my friend Donna Benjamin.
Hello.
So in the past, Donna has helped run a number of mini comps and a number of tutorials. So she's I've learnt all I know about Inkscape from a couple of the sessions that Donna has run on teaching Inkscape, which have subsequently been very useful because I've ended up, when you're organizing a conference, you end up doing 1,000 things that you're not actually an expert at, and designing like graphics and stuff for things is one of those. So that was very useful. And I think it was last year you ran the community leadership summit X, and that's like a hangover from like OzCon or FozCon or something?
Yeah, so the Community Leadership Summit was founded by John O'Bacon, and he runs it each year before OzCon in the United States. And a couple of years back, he said that this could be distributed, and he sort of copied the TEDx model. So he had TED talks, and then increasingly there were TEDx talks happening all around the world. So Jono invited other people to run community leadership summits in their part of the world. And I saw this call go out, and I thought, well, a mini conf at LinuxConf.au would be a perfect place for such a CLSX event. So, you know, and foolishly tweeted that, and someone sort of...
Thanks for volunteering,
yes,
Donna.
Effectively. So then I kind of cursed myself and agreed to run CLSX LCA 2 years ago, I think, now was the first one in Auckland, and again last year. And this year I handed the baton to the fabulous VM Brasseur, who ran it on Monday. On Tuesday. So, yeah. And I think it went well. I was quite sorry I wasn't there.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, I think it clashed with the hardware mini conference, and I'd paid to put a board together, so
yes,
that was not something I could miss, unfortunately.
And it also clashed with the free software law and policy mini conference that I was also assisting,
right,
Deb Nicholson, to run. So
yeah, yeah. I think I got a lot out of the leadership one, but I think it's one of those things where, like in all of these soft squishy things versus, like, I consider myself an engineer. You know, I'm not an engineer because I do software. I'm a pretend engineer. And it's really easy when you're doing these things just to come up, if you're solving a problem, you just come up with a list of pros and cons, and then you just sort of count. and it's like, you know, which one is easy, and if there's a decision to be made, if there's a way to make that decision really easy to make or reversible, just do that one.
If only life was so easily reductive.
When you're running
the rest of life.
Yeah, when you're running a community group, you can't, you know, here's a decision point where if I take one decision, it's going to impact this person. If I take the other one, it's going to impact this person. Which person do I like least? And I'll make that decision. That is not a good way of building a community. So I think also in those sort of things, I sort of feel very comfortable at being the icebreaker, and so whenever there's a group discussion on and it's like discuss the topic, boo, I'm more than happy to jump in and do a brain dump of what I'm feeling about that sort of thing. The other side of it that I do really poorly, of course, is actually listen to everyone else.
The listening part is really useful. I went to a session today by Elizabeth Joseph, who was talking about global communities. And that was one of the things that she talked about, was the importance of listening and listening to people who are not like you, people who are outside of your group, particularly the users that she was working with. They wanted to transition one piece of software they were using for another one. They went, well, this is equivalent, this will do. And basically that group of users sort of had a mutiny and said, no, this won't do. It's nowhere near good enough, and it won't help us do what we need to do.
So and was that user group around that particular bit of software, or was it like they were just using that?
They were users of it. So the context was that it was an open source project and a host, and it had as a service component, and the as a service component stopped being open source. So this project, which was open source, was committed to using open source software and said, okay, so we'll have to stop using that now. And then the community around that, who were using it as a tool to accomplish something particular, went, well, none of these things that you're saying we can use work the way we work, right, do what we need them to do, etc., etc. And so they had a really kind of, you know, frank and fearless kind of series of conversations at summits, getting together face to face and really listening and understanding what those needs were. And it ended up being a great outcome, because they did find another software project, and then that project actually was able to listen to these particular users' needs and hear the features that they needed to accomplish their work and had them add it. And then, you know, it became one of those awesome sorts of results.
Where, but, like, just the effect of communicating clearly actually made the problem sort of much shallower than it otherwise was.
Well, it resolved the problem, full stop, you know, whereas before it was an edict issued from an infrastructure team saying, no, you just have to use the software.
And that was based on a principle of, we're an open source group, we should be using open source stuff. There's a perfectly logical ladder of steps to get to that conclusion.
Yep. Indeed.
It's just that you had to throw people off the ladder at every step to reach the top of it.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that. And so, yeah, the squishy stuff, I actually have a real... I'm increasingly having a visceral revulsion to the term soft skills, because there's nothing soft or easy about the human side of what we do. I have said for a long time that the technical challenges can usually be solved. We may not have all the resources that we need to solve them, but there is usually some path forward. The human challenges are often much more challenging, because sometimes they are intractable, and the solutions are not palatable.
Yeah, there's a talk this afternoon, I think, that I'm looking forward to. Handle conflict like a boss.
Yes, Deb Nicholson, who ran the Free Software Law and Policy.
Yeah. And I think my sort of approach is to pretty much what she's describing, is that if I see a bunch of little issues in a group, I'll just sort of let them slide, and you're not actually dealing, like, there is a conflict there, only one side of it knows that there's a conflict, and then, you know, 6-12 months on, all of these things sort of bubble up and coalesce and you have an explosion.
Yes.
And I think that talk will be very useful for someone like me.
Yeah, and I've seen a different version of that talk from Deb, so I would highly, highly recommend going, because she's a great presenter and she knows her stuff. And, yeah, I've given a talk about conflict at DrupalCon, actually. And one of the things I sort of say is, I think we need to rethink how we generally approach conflict. There's generally... terrible generalizations, but people will avoid conflict as a kind of default natural response and do anything they can to avoid conflict.
It's trying to be polite.
It's trying to be polite. And what I kind of want to say is, let's embrace conflict and talk about constructive conflict resolution. And I say that if there is something which is causing conflict, it's actually an opportunity to make something a whole lot better. If we think about conflicts as kind of the early warning stages of a good bug report, then we might be able to really change the way that we tackle conflict in our communities.
Right,
it's
right.
Like if there's something that's wrong and we've basically created an environment where we're not willing to accept a bug report, we're never going to get the opportunity to fix what's wrong. On the other hand, if we can address those small, niggling, you know, splinters and paper cuts and irritations, then we're more likely to be able to fix things before they develop into kind of thermonuclear global war.
Yep. And I think, I think things like that, it's not, like, it's useful at work, it's useful in the open source crowd. And I think, you know, there are situations where, like, if I'm at work and there's a little niggling thing, you know, I've had a good night's sleep, I've come into work fresh. If I can't deal with it then, how the heck am I going to deal with it after hours where I've been at work for 8 hours and then I've gone home and I'm tired and I'm trying to do open source stuff on my own time? All of my social capital, I'm not quite using the right terms here, but like, you know, there's only so much crap you can take in a day,
mm-hmm.
and that normally is used up by like 10:30 in the morning.
So it's that it's the cognitive load and cognitive calories in a way. Kathy Sierra has lots of great stuff on this, in her recent book she talks about it. There's a study that was done about giving a dog an instruction to stay, and having the same dog be in a cage. The dog that was in a cage didn't need to use any cognitive resources to stay where it was.
Right.
But the dog that was told to sit and stay and wait used cognitive resources just to do that.
Yep.
And, you know, there are other ones about how when you give humans, you know, this half of your audience 2 numbers to memorize and this half of the audience 5 numbers to memorize, and then send them out to morning tea and let them choose cake or fruit. The people who only had to memorize 2 numbers chose fruit more often, and the people who had to choose 5 numbers chose cake, because their willpower, their cognitive load had been eroded by having to do more work.
Right.
Now, there's lots of science out there on this now, but we don't use this knowledge very often.
Yeah.
But what you're describing is, you know, you're on your best behavior all day at work, you've been dealing with issues, you've been doing problem solving, you've been, you know, doing all the awesome stuff, and then you get home, you're like, ugh, and now you're just like, you don't hold back when you want to, you know, spit at your, you know, housemate, or, you know, etc. And you're more likely to kind of let rip and not use your sort of social graces, shall we say, and it's just cognitive load. And we have that in all sorts of other things. And when we make our users work harder than they need to accomplish their tasks, their likelihood of being frustrated and not getting done what they want to get done goes up, because we're making them waste cognitive resource on stuff that doesn't matter, as opposed to focus their cognitive resource on the stuff that does.
Yep.
I went off on a really crazy tangent
there. No. I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think it's understanding and realizing that we might be producing code and programs and documentations of the day, like they might be real things that we can point at and play with and use, but the journey to get there, it's all people, it's all brains, and we, you know, except for a few people on the very fringes, we all intrinsically have a lot of stuff wrapped up in our rational brains. We never just use our rational brains. Every decision we make, there's biases, there's history, there's energy levels, there's emotions, all the way through.
And some people say we actually post-rationalize what are much more lizard brain responses and reactions to things than many of us care to admit. Yeah, definitely. Definitely a thing. Definitely a thing. You know, I am talking tomorrow on a sort of similar topic in a way. My talk title is "I Am Your User, Why Do You Hate Me?" And this comes from my experience, like, being an absolute passionate advocate for open source software. It's awesome. It's wonderful. But it's also a little bit rough around the edges at times. And I've found myself bumping my head against things, not being able to figure something out. And, you know, I'm sure people will say, well, Donna, that's because, you know, you're deficient in some way.
You're not hardcore enough.
Well, I'm not hardcore enough. But I'm sort of increasingly the case, well, actually, I am pretty good. When there is a way, I will often find it. I have to be tenacious sometimes and, you know, try things in a different kind of way. But it gets really hard. And then I spent some time working for some other organisations which weren't, you know, drinking the free software Kool-Aid, and found things were just very strangely easy. Smooth, simple. I didn't have to think about how to use it or where to start, and just found that the guide rails and pathways were smooth, and, you know, the desire lines were taking me where I wanted to go as opposed to somewhere else.
So then
I've come back to free software and kept bumping my head against things again. And this is where, you know, my kind of long-running private rant with Leslie Hawthorne of I am your user, why do you hate me, really came back to the fore. It's like, why is this so hard?
Yep.
It shouldn't be. It doesn't need to be. Why is it that proprietary software and solutions can make it really easy for me to focus on the thing I want to do as opposed to focusing on the technology that you know, to enable the thing that I want to do? There has to be something here we need to pay more attention to.
Yep.
And I feel like in some ways I have enormous privilege in this community, in the open source community, to be able to sort of stand up and be prepared to look and feel stupid and say, hey, it's just not good enough.
Yep.
And it's not good enough for us to turn around and say, it's the user's fault.
So I'm hearing, I think I'm hearing, user interface is poor, user experience side is poor, documentation is lacking, installation side of things is lacking. Are there any other components that I'm sort of missing?
Even data flows, the connections between things. And, you know, it's a big, complex, hairy area in that, you know, some of the providers of these kinds of tools in the proprietary space own the ecosystem, so it's definitely a lot easier to make things seamless. But the problem is that our reaction is generally to go back and blame the user. And my talk goes into, you know, the number of stupid users, not just in open source, but in lots of technology. We talk about users as stupid.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that it's their deficiency that's the problem and not our product or our solution or our software. We also, when we talk about users, when we go back to a very sort of fundamental definition, we talk about it being their lack of expertise which defines them. And, you know, this is kind of part of the problem, I think. And I say I think here because I don't know. I feel like I'm beginning to poke at a problem and I haven't really completely understood it yet. And that's why I want to talk about it. And why I want to talk about it at a place like LinuxConf.au is say, we really need to get to the heart of what it is that we're doing here. Is it a fundamental disrespect for the user as this faceless kind of entity? Or is it something that we're not being able to kind of wear someone else's shoes and understand what's going on? So the example that, you know, Elizabeth was talking about earlier in a global communities talk was a really good example of it, where it went, we stopped being us and started listening to them and then became a whole, became a we.
So you actually, like, invite your users into your community.
Yes, very much so. And Genevieve Bell, who, you know, keynoted at LCA a few years ago, has done lots of awesome research on the users of technology. And I have this sneaking suspicion, and I don't know if this was my idea or I've read it somewhere else, that if we were to actually acknowledge and engage with the users of our software as first-class citizens in our community, we would have a very different issue with diversity than we do now.
Right.
Because the users of a there are more of them, full stop, than the developers and the creators of things. And they will also have real life feedback and real life use cases. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, really healthy open source communities, they talk about contributors rather than just privileging developers, for instance.
Yep.
And anyone can contribute, whether it's a bug report, and that goes back to what we're talking about, conflict, that you have this moment where, okay, there's something not quite right here. It's an opportunity to make it better, to smooth that down. I mean, maybe a nice analogy would be, okay, here's a rough edge. Let's just get a little bit of sandpaper on that and bring our craftsman's skills to hone and smooth and perfect rather than necessarily, oh, look, you've just got a splinter and that's your fault.
And I think, I mean, like, the other side of the coin is that, like, the you know, one of the reasons that you could suggest is that the cause of open source software being a bit crap when it comes to the user experience side of things is because most people are doing it as a part-time thing. and you know they're not doing it for money. They see a need for a feature, they add the feature, and they can get it to work, and then they go to bed. And getting people to treat the user interface side of things and the ease of use side of things, and I think that's a phrase that's sort of born out of popularity. I'm not a big follower on all these things. But getting people to treat that as work and not just, oh, we'll fix that up in the documentation. I think that would require a real mindset change. But yeah, it's definitely a thing. And I mean, I sort of see it at different levels because, so I'm someone who's interested at the lower layers of things. Like I'm kernel and two or three layers above that. Over the last three or four, five years actually, we've seen a number of lower order systems get swapped around and changed around. And for a lot of people, that they only sort of realizing this now with systemd being put in place and that being a big thing. But there's a lot of layers underneath that that have changed dramatically. And because they were backwards compatible, most people didn't really see the changes being made. And now that systemd is exposing some of these issues, people are having to go in and try to understand how these small components work, like LoginD, for example, which when you log in, it tracks if you're a local user or a remote user logged in, and you get different permissions based on that, whether or not you can muck around with physical devices locally attached or remotely attached. And none of that stuff is really well documented at all. And because it worked so well when we were installing it in the background 2 or 3 years ago, no one really cared. But now that systemd is sort of exposing some of the issues that some of this software has, we're all screwed, and everyone's just jumping up and down because nobody knows how any of this stuff works. And it's exactly the same sort of stuff. The only documentation for this stuff is a couple of skimpy little man pages. You read those and you don't have any idea what they're doing because they're using these completely foreign concepts that you've never actually had a look at before. And, you know, if I go and use, like Inkscape is a good example. If I don't go and use Inkscape every 6 months or so, everything that I've ever learned to do, I completely forget about. And, you know, I end up having to go to YouTube videos to, you know, I need to, you know, I've got a JPEG and I want to convert it to a bitmap or something like that so I can do some nice scaling. Like I've hand-drawn a logo and I want to vectorize it. I end up having to go and do YouTube searches for all of these things because you look through the menus and you look through the help system, I don't even know what terms to search for. And, you know, you spend half your day just figuring out with Google what the heck you're actually trying to say. So it's not like I think what I'm trying to say there is that developers are users as well. All of our computers are layered in such a way that we are users of another layer underneath. And even the kernel guys, you know, they're still using an interface that the hardware is providing them. So we're all users of software and hardware at some point in time. And if the developers of software can sort of think back in time a little bit to the last time that they were frustrated by how a bit of hardware or software worked, they might be able to reflect on that and try to provide a better experience to their own users.
Couldn't agree more. And I think that's the key, is really understanding that we are all users. We do all use technology. We don't create all the technology that we use unless we're particularly genius human beings. But, you know, also it comes back to, we focus a lot on the technology and things like this, but we create technology for people, even if it's just ourselves and the scratching your own itch analogy. And it's people who create it. And I would really like us to get away from two things. One is talking about soft skills, and the other is talking about users. I'd really like us to be talking about people and human skills or communication skills or management skills or whatever, rather than kind of devaluing what's involved in that skill set by saying this is soft and this is hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They are. It's a different skill set. It's this interesting thing where, because I don't have people skills, I feel it's okay to put people skills down. And like I've sort of grown up quite early on, sort of being rubbed up the wrong way with teaching.
Haven't we all?
Well, in my lifetime, I've come across a number of people saying things like, "People who can do stuff, and the people who can't teach," and that has never made any sense to me. Like from grade, 8 or 9, because I've always been pretty good at maths, I would always get dragged along to help the kids that were having trouble with maths. And it is one thing to be good at something and be able to do it. It is completely another thing to be able to take a concept in your mind, spin it 180, and explain it to somebody else in their terms. And I get constantly frustrated at people who denigrate teachers and teaching just because it's a skill set that they don't have. And it's the same thing with design. And there are aspects of design I don't like. Like there's the whole colour scheme thing. Like it's almost a fashion thing these days where every couple of years it's like, you know, shades are in or pastels are in. And it's like, you know, every new web framework, they have to have a colour set. And unfortunately, like, it doesn't mean anything, but that is because we're visual creatures, that is what everyone sort of combs in around. And it's the lack of, I think it's that difference of, that inability to be able to build on top of a previous toolkit and to improve it incrementally. That doesn't seem to happen. All I ever see is like, this is a completely new toolkit. It's better than all the other toolkits because we've built it from the ground up. And it's, and you know, things like the Google toolkit, which is not just a graphical toolkit, but it's a whole...
So the material design.
The material design, yep. Yeah. It's a whole process. Like if you're trying to get your user to select multiple things from a list, this is the entire approach that you should take. So that all of the apps on the phone are exactly the same. And I'm all for that sort of thing. But in another 2 or 3 years' time, there'll be another toolkit.
Well, I'm seeing the other end of that at the moment with the Yahoo user interface widgets and tools that were available years ago,
yep,
for the web.
Yep.
They're still being used in some parts of, yes, Moodle. Moodle have recently decided to refactor and use Bootstrap, and it's yet another one. But you can still see YUI in the source code,
yep,
of Moodle theme stuff all over the place. And that's kind of this thing. So these different frameworks come along, and you adopt them, and you build on it, and then at some point in time, it kind of either dwindles away or what have you, and there's something else comes along. So yeah, very much agree with you that you know, it would be so much nicer if we could. I mean, I don't think we're ever going to completely undo that, and you've got to have some space for innovation and a new crazy way of doing things.
Yep.
But it would be great if we could do more evolution rather than revolution with,
yeah,
these things,
yeah,
and do more building,
yeah,
on what came before.
Yeah.
To some extent, we probably use ideas, even if we're building from scratch. We're using,
yeah,
ideas where,
yep,
we've learned that, hey, that wasn't a great way to,
yep,
do it. But yeah, there's a lot of obsolete,
yes,
stuff,
yes,
which still runs the world.
Yeah, like as a developer, something like material design. Like if I'm doing foo, this is how you do foo, and I would love for that just to be true. But I know in 3 or 4 years' time, there'll be a different approach that is thought of as best in class.
Yes,
and So because I know that the thing I'm learning today won't be the thing that I need tomorrow, I just won't bother learning that thing that I need to do today.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, really quite sad.
But also just human. It's just the reality of it. We make choices all the time about where we invest our energy, our time, our resources. It comes back to that cognitive cognitive resource as well. It's like, this is going to take me time to learn to do it this proper way, or I could do this quick, dirty hack and get to where I'm actually trying to go today.
Yep.
You know, we make those trade-offs all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the time. I think that the kind of different use cases are important there. There's been a debate in the Drupal community around Bootstrap.
Okay.
Which is a really good example. So Bootstrap, I think, was developed originally by Twitter.
Yep.
It's kind of become almost ubiquitous.
Yep.
As a kind of quick and dirty way of getting stuff on the web.
Yes.
And someone basically took the Bootstrap framework and turned it into a Drupal-based theme. And there's a conversation going on in the Drupal community about, hey, it's probably time that we got a new theme for Drupal core, and, you know, how should we go about that? You know, is it about shiny design to show what Drupal's capable of? Is it about, you know, creating, you know, guidelines and handrails for helping people to do their first theme and learn how to theme? Or is it about having something out of the box for people who just want to get content online using a content management system as quickly as possible and have it look okay?
Yep.
Very, very different use cases.
Yep.
For all three of those things. And so the debate is kind of wild. And I think Mark Carver, who is the maintainer of Bootstrap in Drupal, sort of said, well, his vision for what the Bootstrap theme is to allow people to use Drupal and get stuff online. If they want to start making it look different, they should do a sub-theme, and they're going to take that in an entirely different direction. And his view is that trying to make a pretty theme shouldn't not try to be a framework either. But, you know, it's like they're really, some of these ideas are competing, right? And
yep.
Someone at some point is going to have to, you know, put that stake in the sand and say, this is what we're doing with this initiative. We can't serve all of those different
yep.
use cases. So, you know, also I was in Russell Keith McGee's session on A Stranger in a Strange Land, and he was talking about PyBeware and you know, creating Python so that it can be used on mobile devices.
Yep.
And all sorts of devices.
Yep.
We also talked about how Python is being used in, you know, in the scientific community. These are people who are not software developers by trade. These are people who are scientists trying to wrangle data, and they're kind of programming because it helps them get to where they need
yep.
to go. And that was like this little moment where it went ting in my head, because it's also the way I talk about the people who use our software. Instead of talking about them as users, they're not users of our software. Our software is irrelevant to them. They're trying to accomplish some task or goal. They don't see themselves as a, you know, I'm an Inkscape user. No, I'm a designer, or I'm
using a hammer and I'm using a drill.
Correct,
yeah.
Right? And I think we suffer from forgetting that too often. And Kathy Sierra, and I've got a call out to Kathy Sierra in my talk tomorrow, is people don't want to be awesome users of a tool. They want to be awesome at the thing the tool allows them to do.
Yep.
And we forget that. And when we reduce humans to being users, we obliterate that reality.
Right.
So I don't know what we do about that, but I want to start calling it out. And
sure.
I want us to start thinking about greasing the wheels, smoothing the banisters, making it as easy as possible to do the thing that they came to do, and stop effectively abusing them for not being as smart as we are.
Right. So I mean, we're sort of we've got a pedestal there, and we've put the thing that we've spent our time and hard earned sweat and tears, we've put the software on the pedestal, and we should be putting our users on the pedestal, and our software should just be the thing that's making the pedestal tall.
Yes. I agree with the sentiment that you've expressed there, but I don't want us putting users on pedestals. I want us embracing users as part of our community.
Okay.
As us.
Yep.
Not as them.
Yep. Okay. Cool. Is there anything else you would like to discuss? I think I've kept you for about half an hour now.
I think I've probably said as many obscene and offensive things as I can possibly say to them.
I hope that when you give your talk that you can put as much vehemence into your talk and convince as much of the audience as you've been able to convince me.
Thank you, Clinton.
Thank you very much, Donna.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hekka Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.